This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by the first edition of Rust and Water. We are about to print and get into our second edition of Rust and Water without the double the. So this is your last chance to get the original first edition of Rust and Water from chasingartwork.com. Every book comes with a sketch and a signature.
Attention, citizens, it's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork. My name is Gregory Kamichuk, and joining us today, also on the podcast, is our producer extraordinaire, Dan Vadaboncour. And we are going to talk today, whether these guys are ready or not, about an old book. We're going to go on a learning journey back 5 years from today.
Can we call it a learny?
A learny. Come with us on a learny to 5 years ago when two plucky creatives, Justin and Gregory, are putting together their book, Rust and Water. And now fast forward to just the last week when Justin had to redesign the entire book.
No. You guys only spent like 2 seconds back there. Let's think about it. What was it? 2016? What was
2016?
The world like?
What was the world like? We went to shows like crazy.
Yeah.
I went to Chicago that year.
2016?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I
mean, my son was four. Man, my other son was, it's too long. I can't go there because there's so much joy and openness left in that world and it's all closed off now. But what I can say about that past world is that we certainly have learned a lot between then and here about how to put a book together. Would you agree with that, Justin?
It's true. Yeah. And how to organize your final book files was something that I was reminded about while working on this.
Right. Which is a good segue because when you're young and optimistic about your file trees and how you could never possibly forget where the important details of your book are on your hard drive, when you're working on it, it's important to remember that those times disappear. That memory fades for a reason, and that they become hidden in a really terrible naming system, don't they, Justin?
Well, it wasn't the naming system. So here's what happened. We have a distributor for Rust and Water, and so they are taking the book and doing a print on demand service. So you order the book and they print it as you order it. Whereas when we originally printed the book, we did a large run of a couple thousand books, and then we had that stack of books. So because we're doing this print-on-demand service, when you do on print-on-demand, they usually only have a couple standard sizes, and you need to conform to those standard sizes, and that's why they can do them so quickly, is because they just have those core sizes. So Rust and Water was originally 8.5 by 12, and with this new printer, it had to be 8.5 by 11, which doesn't sound like too big of a deal. But then when you get into the art files and realize you have to like get rid of an inch on either side, and some of those panels on the side are only an inch and a half wide, you know, you end up having to crop and shuffle around quite a few things.
Does it end up changing the proportion of the page?
Oh, a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not quite as wide. It really didn't look too different at the end, but it was just, you know, once you change one thing, you have to change the other. So just kind of like it cascades through the entire page. You can't just have one skinny panel on the edge. You kind of have to like crop them all to make them all a little skinnier. So the whole page looks consistent again. So I go into my Rust and Water file tree, which again is 5 years old. And the way I build books is usually I have...
I'm going to interrupt for a second.
Yeah.
for the sake of the dear listener, how do you store your files so that 5 years later you can find them again? So what is it? What's the process? Do you have a physical hard drive, or is it all on a Dropbox or a cloud-based? People, inquiring minds will want to know.
Okay. For like my painting work files, I usually have them on Dropbox and on a storage. I just have a storage hard drive on my computer. And when they're really, really old, they do get put onto a portable hard drive and taken off the computer completely. My books, I keep my books around always, from computer to computer. The original book files always stick around so I can get at them whenever. And I use Dropbox a lot as well. I bought the unlimited or 100, whatever, like a terabyte or whatever it is on Dropbox. I paid money for extra storage on Dropbox because I use it a ton, and it does make me feel a lot better knowing that a lot of my stuff is on a cloud somewhere. I have a Mac, so I have the Time Machine as well. So I've got a bunch of things in place.
When we store on the cloud-based stuff, if you're traveling from city to city and you're setting up printing files or getting test prints done at different printers, it can be really useful to have really high resolution files at the touch of a keystroke to then do some test printing wherever you are.
Yes. Yes, for sure. So with book files, I've gotten a lot better at this, but back in the Rust and Water days, I had a really hard time finding the final file. Because near the end of the project, when all the artwork is done, then there was a new file that was added just for the writing. And then that went through a couple iterations as well. So I had like a final artwork file, and then a final artwork text file, and then a final file. You know, like I had way too many files that looked like they were the final file. And I found one that I was pretty certain was the final file, and I put about 2 hours of work into it. And then as I got to the last 6 or 8 pages of the book, I realized some things were missing. Mm-hmm. And I had been working on the InDesign that was 95% finished, but it was not the final file. And so I really was kicking myself because I did the thing that the project was finished and I got it out the door. And then I didn't take that extra hour or two to organize things in a way that the version of me that wasn't in that folder every day was going to be able to find them. Right. Like it all made sense because I was working in that file tree every day, 12 to 16 hours a day for like the last couple weeks leading up to the book being done. But then when I had to step away, it didn't make sense to unfamiliar Justin. And it, it cost me a couple hours of my time. So I spent some time reorganizing all of Rust and Water's crazy files. And now I know where everything is. And in 10 years from now, I have to go back in there. It's all clearly labeled. When the final thing you do, once the book is out the door and in the printers, you should take the time and think about if you have to come back here in 10 years, or if somebody who has never been in here before has to come looking for the final file of the book, make it so they can find it. Right? Like, Gregory, if you were hit by a bus tomorrow, yeah, and I had to go into your computer and finish your unfinished books, would I be able to find anything useful?
Interesting you say that. Well, so yes and no. I've been better lately. And so it used to be, so just to give people who aren't familiar with maybe like a digital workflow, if you're working on comics traditionally, then you're doing them, you know, basically a page at a time, and you tend to do them in order if you're going traditionally because you're sticking to the script. If you're doing it where you're doing all the parts, there can be a lot of different versions, drafts, and things that you're figuring out. So what I do is I create an InDesign document and I drop in images into the InDesign document from sometimes different projects, from this project. Like I try to fill in the flow of the story all the way to the end. And why this is important is because then that one place has the complete story in order. and it links to all kinds of different wild places all over my hard drive, but it's all connected and can be batched and copied out as one file so that that book has one file tree at the end when I'm done it. So any book that's finished, you could definitely find because I batch it out so that it's all collected into one place. Books that are in the process of being finished, you would have to use the same trick that I do if I come back to something after a month of not working on it. I arrange my hard drive so that it feeds me information in the order that it was last opened, right? You know, you can adjust how you see a file. And so it'll prioritize the ones that were most recently opened. That's how I do it. So it can be daunting even later to come back and try and figure out what it was you were trying to say or do. Yeah, it's hard.
It comforts me to know that your life was not too dear a price to pay for love of your fellow men. I'm afraid I don't understand. At the moment, I don't intend that you should.
I often, especially with big projects, I like fresh starts every, you know, every couple of percentages through the project. Like my first file, once I've you know, I'm 30 to 40% through the project, I like to kind of start with a new InDesign and kind of only bring over the clean stuff and kind of declutter it and just tighten everything up. And I kind of do that periodically. I'll just kind of start a new book file and incorporate just the newer, better, cleaner work. So I end up with kind of a bunch of those files by the end.
Yeah. Another thing that I've been doing the last couple of years is I will export super, super overly high resolution PDFs from, you know, like you only need 300 DPI for print. You know, some people like 450. I'll export 600 DPI PDFs of even drafts. And I just store them away on a separate hard drive so that if everything got lost, I could go back to those really high resolution exports and reconstruct pages from that.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Right. Just so that I have it. Yeah.
Make like a print version of the book every so often, just in case there is something.
Have you
ever had a catastrophic system failure where you lost, like really lost work?
Not since I switched to Mac.
No?
No.
What happened before the Mac?
Before the Mac on PCs, almost like to clockwork with the warranty of the computer, the hard drive would have some kind of catastrophic failure and I would lose an enormous amount of work.
Was this kind of pre cloud servers and
portable hardware? My vintage here, right? So like these were early. So now I don't think there's as much of a difference between PC and Mac as far as like those backups and cloud saves and all that kind of stuff. But one of the big reasons why I switched was back in those days, I had a collaborator I was working on some comic stuff with who was on a Mac. And I was like on my fifth time complaining about losing work. And he was like, why are you using those junk computers? Right. And he had never seemed to have this problem. And that was the big push for me over the edge. Most of my catastrophic things are solved by the fact that I back up stuff in multiple locations. So every couple of days I back it up onto a physical hard drive and then also to the cloud. And then I'm doing those regular PDF exports. So I've had stuff where, you know, like InDesign crashes and I lose some stuff, or Photoshop crashes and I lose an hour or two of work, but that's all I'm losing because I'm pretty careful, right? Is like an hour or two. And to be honest, almost any work that you do, if you're only losing an hour or two of it, it's probably better that you had the practice. Turns out better.
Yeah. Isn't that a little frustrating when that happens to me as well. Like usually at worst, I lose an hour or two. And then when I redo that work, it's better the second time around. And I find myself wondering, like, should I be redoing my work more often through this process? Because apparently doing it twice makes it better.
Well, you know, practice, always with practice.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm more concerned about losing these days is like in a catastrophic, you know, like house failure or flood or fire or whatever, is the accumulated knowledge in all these sketchbooks. I do so much actual like tactile work that's just for me or for my family or with my family or whatever, that's the stuff I'd worry about losing, honestly. It's the stuff that it's impossible to replace because there is only one.
So many notes and little ideas, and yeah. How often do you go back through older sketchbooks?
Pretty often. Yeah. Every now and then, like in a week. So like just within my reach here, I have these five or six sketchbooks that are right here, and then another stack a little bit buried of stuff that is stuff I've been going back to because they're ideas I can't quite let go. And I've been refining some of this stuff that's in here. So I go back fairly often and try to reiterate, but it's mostly because I told myself long ago that I didn't believe in writer's block. And so in order to facilitate what I feel is like no loss of creative output, whenever I'm like, I don't know what to do, I take one of those old sketchbooks and I just develop one of those ideas where most of the work's already done. It feels almost like cheating, like looking off somebody's test, right? And they've got most of the answer and you could probably, you know, figure out the rest. That's what it feels like for me.
Yeah, I find that as well. Like I can never make the claim that I have nothing to do because I have sketchbooks and sketchbooks of ideas for paintings and projects and little things to do here and there. And so I'm ever struck with that I don't know what to work on, all I have to do is flip back a couple pages and find a bunch of ideas from past Justin to work on.
Yeah. And lately, one of the things I've been trying to do is when I feel like scrolling through social media, instead I scroll through an old sketchbook. Like if I'm here at my desk working and, you know, you have that moment where you're like, you feel that itch to like just see what the world is doing. I've been resisting that and going back and just looking at work and trying to refine, just trying to wean myself off the glass tablet addiction.
It's a little self-indulgent, but okay.
Yeah, well, you know, what better way to combat everyone else's ego on social media than just with books filled with my own ego?
Yeah, who cares what other people are up to? Let's see what I was thinking about a couple days ago.
That's so true. So true. But you know what's great is like some of these sketchbooks go back to 2016 when we were so optimistic about our future. So that's kind of nice. Dan, I'd be curious to know if it's different in audio files.
Well, you guys know that I am not great with this stuff. And in fact, this is why I've been quiet this whole time. I'm sure I've lost a few episodes of this podcast and my own podcast. That's just because it does have to do with file labeling. And it's because this computer that I have is a certain amount of files on it. And I work a lot with, like, even for my teaching job, I use a lot of video as part of my presentations and all kinds of other things. So
huge file sizes.
Yeah, that's huge. And then all these other audio files aren't as big, but I have a lot of them. So that builds up. So every once in a while, I get that warning on my computer, like, your computer is too slow. It's going to explode, whatever. It's just like, warning. Danger, Will Robinson. So I'm like, oh, crap, I got to delete some files. So I bring the thing up and it shows me, like, how files in certain size order, and I usually delete the WAV files because those are bigger than MP3s. But the ones the times I've lost it from this podcast has been they've been not labeled properly. Files like that I've accidentally deleted. That's what's happening.
Always our best, most insightful episodes with the most intelligent.
We'll never know. We'll never know. Well, So anyway, as far as audio goes, I mean, it's not quite the same as publishing. Audio, we just play it. It's on. If you hear it, it's published, right? So you don't have to worry about different file types. There's no printing of anything. Certainly, if you want to create a recording, like a CD or any other type of professional recording, there has to be certain quality levels that you have to achieve. But the internet has kind of taken that away a little bit, I think, as far as audio publications go. So
I think that's totally true.
There's a fork on your left, Mr. Land, or aren't you accustomed to utensils?
I'm indifferent to him.
I've been working with my kids on some stuff from, prehistory or early history. There was a time when, like, if you wanted to write something down, first you had to invent a pen, and then you had to hope someone else had invented paper. Right? Like, we've gone a long way to the point where, like, oh, no, I have so many you know, terabytes of data, right? We're almost like, it's an embarrassment of riches. How dare we use up all those great terabytes? One of the things I wanted to ask you both, when you are looking back through your old file trees, how do you decide what does go? What are you deleting?
It doesn't spark any joy.
You're a monster.
But no, like it's kind of like often every once in a while I'll go through like a bunch of, I call them forges. Like I have some Illustrator files that are just full of like sketches and reference material for like a potential piece. And if I go in there and it's just like the idea of that piece no longer has it. Yeah. It doesn't spark joy. It doesn't bring, like, I have no interest in it. I just can't see it being exciting to work on. Then that idea has just kind of, you know, it's been snuffed out. It kind of lost its chance. So scrap that. And I've got dozens more. So on to the next one.
Oftentimes, yeah, older files are gone. The older the thing is, it's usually the least relevant. In my case,
if it's still got some merit to the idea, usually then it just gets remixed into something newer.
Yeah.
Like the core, something of the core of that idea is great. So I'm gonna come up with something new and updated to work on in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll sometimes take sort of like two. I'll have two file trees of like maybe half a dozen to a dozen illustrations that didn't quite coalesce into a real idea. And then I'll take those and I'll just like spend an evening trying to see if I can make something out of those two dead ideas, like splice together. I'll open an InDesign document and I'll just at random drop stuff from both file trees and then shuffle the pages around and see, is there a different story that I wouldn't have thought of if I didn't have these two decks of cards in a way?
Right. And there's not much stress or pressure there, right? It's kind of like they're, you know, there's no risk involved.
That's absolutely it. That's why I like it, because it's already like, I've already sort of abandoned it, but I've done a bunch of work. And even if I only get like a little 3-page comic or a 5-page little something out of smashing it together, I've at least salvaged some of that time.
See, that's my art book. That's where a lot of ideas go to die, is I'm not going to put in the extra however many hours or days or weeks to finish this, but at least I can put it into a presentable version and put it in my next art book and kind of attach a paragraph of what I was thinking and why I don't think it's going to work anymore and what I'm going to be recycling into another idea. And then it's at least like I didn't waste that evening when I started that project. It's still going somewhere and people do get to see a glimmer of it. So that has helped a lot in the last couple of years, having that. I release an art book every 2 to 3 years, knowing that every bit of work that I've done, I can throw in there and nothing gets completely wasted.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have enough of a following that instead of like having a regular blog, you just publish an art book, which is what goes on most people's regular blog, right? Which is like all your starts and stops and your progressions and like how your style maybe has shifted or what you're thinking on or focusing, what you're in love with. That all goes into a new edition of the art book. I think it's so great. Now, if somebody who's listening said, wait, art books, where do I find those? I didn't know we were doing an ad for your art books, but we are now. What? Where do they go and find those?
I do have them on chasingartwork.com, but the like originally, those were Comic-Con, like I only sold them at conventions. I didn't have them in bookstores. I didn't even really have them online until 2019 when the event happened. When the event...
That shall not be named. The event that shall not be named.
The event.
Is that what we're doing here?
Yeah. Okay. Don't think about the event.
The event.
But I do have art book number 4 is where I'm at. I'm about to, I don't exactly know what I'm doing with my fourth one because they were always something so tied to in-person events. I've been kind of holding off on my fourth art book. So it was supposed to be around 100 pages, and now it's creeping up to it could be, you know, 150 to 170 with all this new work I've done. So I have this internal dilemma about, do I start on art book number 5 and then I can have like one kind of, you know, ready to print and another one in the process, or do I have kind of the event art book, which is now twice as big as I thought it was going to be, a 200 page art book that comes out. I don't know. Yeah. So I'm stuck a little bit with my art book because of where the world's at. But
yeah, since the event, I've gotten quite backed up with projects too. Like the number of things I have to release versus the number of places to release them is definitely something to consider, which is partially why the file tree conversation came up, right? Someone came to us and said, it was Mythos and Inc. is the publisher. They came to us and said, we would like to work with you on releasing this book in some new markets. How would we do that? And so we looked at some books that we were planning to give more attention to with boots on the ground that we couldn't. And so that's how Rust and Water got selected. So yeah, we're just doing what we can since the event. I like calling it that. I'm not really big on bypassing, but we talk about it enough in our regular lives. So
it makes me smile as well, because there's a great sketch comedy show called The Mitchell and Webb Show. I think it's Mitchell and Webb. And they have a great skit about the event. YouTube Mitchell and Webb, the event, if you want to laugh. They're great sketch comedy.
Now, Gregory, I have to ask, what are you drawing here? We have for those who are listening, we have the camera. Gregory's camera is pointed down at his pad, is his book that he's talking about. And you're drawing what looks to me, can I guess at what it is?
Sure. Yeah.
It looks like that all these robots, these four robots at the top, are throwing this other robot out of an establishment, or they're carrying him off somewhere. So what's happening?
Well, we were talking about, like, yeah, as we were discussing the old and the new, I started drawing this like old school robot with lots of ports and like wires, and then like a mob of slightly more advanced robots just throwing him to the curb. Yeah, you got it. You got it. Okay. It was mostly unconscious until you pointed it out.
What's the story here, though? What's the why? What are they doing to this guy?
I don't know. Why do you throw your old files out, Dan? Why are you such a monster?
Right? I don't have room for them anymore. I don't have room for them anymore.
It used to mean something to you, Dan, and now it's just so much garbage that you would just delete it without a second thought. Room. Right? Oh, that's the trap of cloud services, though.
I know. No, I try to avoid that. I remember the day that Google, all of a sudden, like it was like day and night, Google just like flipped a switch, and I didn't have the 90 free gigs that I thought I had. And they brought it down to 15 free gigs, and I had to get rid of like 75 gigs worth of data. I had to figure out what to do with it. Yeah, I lost a lot of stuff that time.
Actually, he regrets saving my life as much as I would regret saving his. The only difference is that I wouldn't have tried.
I remember getting my first USB for college, and it was, I think it was like $115.
Oh my God.
For a 1 gig jump drive. And that was like, man, I was hot shit when I came to college with a 1 gig jump drive. That was unheard of.
Oh, wow. Oh man. I used to print my essays on those little dot matrix printers. I was like,
yeah.
Oh my God. If you tried to send anything over 25 megabytes, the university would turn off. Like the whole place would just shut down. The lights would turn off. Alarms would sound. So we've come a long way, I think.
It's true.
Yeah, right?
It's true.
Yeah, it's totally wild to think about. A couple of people have been asking me about my sketchbooks recently and what I plan to do with them. I wonder, is there a merit to scanning like my favorite 200 pages out of these drawn sketchbooks and putting them together into some other thing, right? It's literally the work that no one would ever see unless I did that. But I'm often, I'm the most self-conscious about these kinds of drawings because they don't have a, you know, their purpose is practice more than anything else.
If they suddenly had a purpose, then they would change, right? If you knew they were going towards something, you probably would be doing different stuff.
Yeah, I wonder.
They would lose their purpose. If they had a purpose, they would lose their purpose.
Yeah. Special purpose. Any fans of The Jerk out there will know that we don't mean a special purpose. That's something different. Right? Dan is shaking his head. No pee-pee jokes in the podcast. Tell me about your feelings with Rust and Water now that it's ready for the world in a brand new pair of shorts.
It was really nice going through that story again. It's when you're making the book, it's kind of hard to see the forest for the trees. Like, you're so close to everything and so laser focused on that print deadline that you can't, it's hard to appreciate it from afar. And now that it's been 6 years since I've really taken a close look at that book, it was kind of like looking at somebody else's work and really, I really like what we did there. And then Gregory and I had to go through it with him reading the story and me making changes here and there. So I got to like have it read to me as well, which was kind of nice. So it was,
we had a nice little storybook session last night where I read through and we made a few substantive edits and a few copy edit changes. And those of you who have the original printing of the book, we fixed that double the, I promise it's fixed. It has haunted us low these many years.
I can't remember if I noticed that or not.
Oh, I'm sure you did. You were probably like, you amateurs. That's probably what you thought.
Me and my daughter's room, I'll go look.
Right.
There was this great moment. I think we were in Vancouver and Rust and Water had just came out. Rust and Water was published around October. And in November, we went to Vancouver for a show and a family came by with a young kid. He had to be like 9, 10, 11. Like he was quite young. He bought Rust and Water and he, you know, got a sketch in it and Greg drew in it. He was really excited about it. And then the next day he came back and he just had this look of like smug purpose on his face as he like beeline straight to my booth and he plopped the book down and he flipped to a page that he had marked and he pointed out this, we had a double the on the page. We had like a glaring grammatical mistake that what, four people missed? Yeah, I missed it. Gregory missed it. My mom missed it. Sam did some work on this one. Yeah, we had like a whole bunch of people miss this. And this 11-year-old kid was like, you have a mistake in this book. I immediately sent him to Gregory. I threw Gregory under the bus like right away. I'm like, I just do the art. The writer's over there.
Oh, my goodness. That's not the story I thought you were going to tell.
No,
that one hurts a lot more. I thought you were going to tell the story about that. Oh no, because it was a daughter that came with the super tattered copy of Cassie and Tonk.
Oh, that was
red until it was like about to fall apart. And they were come to get Rust and Water. They came to get our new thing. And we just like, you know, I don't know anyone out there who's ever made anything, you know, that you're looking for that one person who loves it as much as you did making it. And that makes every other thing worth it. And we met that person and she had a copy of this book and it was just about to fall apart. It had been read so many times and they had bought it, not from us, if you recall. So they didn't have the sketch in it the first time. Somewhere they had got it as a gift or somewhere. And it became real weird because almost there are the rare books of Cassie and Tonk are the ones that don't have drawings in them. So if you really want to know if you have a rare edition, we didn't draw in it. It's rare. There's only a few of them that made it out the door like that. And so then we got to draw in it for the first time.
I know the reason for that because there should never be any of our books out there without drawings in it. But I think we had done a book signing at a Calgary bookstore at their mall at the Indigo. And at the very end of the book signing, they wanted to keep like 15 books and we were already late for something else. Or we were on our way out. So we didn't have time to do 15 sketches to leave. And I think that's where she got her book. And then she brought it to us at the Calgary convention the next year.
And nothing made me more happy than drawing in that book for her. And then we spiffed her off and her family off with a bunch of stuff. I just can remember being like, and take this, and take this too.
Yes,
and take
this,
and take this too. And here's a button. And if I had shirts, I would have given her like, it was just like, you somehow want them to understand how much it matters that much to them. I mean, it sounds funny, but I mean, I am the same kind of guy who will look through my own sketchbooks and be like, oh, great idea. So, you know, you got to take it all with a grain of salt. Oh man. What will be the error that we missed on Rust and Water? As soon as you send it.
A double the.
No, we go without the double the. My son is throwing shade from the other room. Oh my goodness. No, I think... I don't know what it'll be. It'll be something in the back matter, I'm sure.
Maybe this time it'll be drawings.
Yeah, maybe the drawings are bad. Thank you. Thank you, son. Maybe Justin made a mistake in the art this time.
I think with pretty much all of the books that Gregory and I have worked on, I usually get my mom to come in at one point or another to do some edits. She gets to see one of the very first versions of the book, and I ask her to kind of look over the words in the story and to make edits, because she's really good at that kind of stuff. And it really makes me smile, and it really bugs Gregory. She's made the comment before in writing. I think, did we put this on the back of a book one time?
It is somewhere, yeah.
The artwork is great, but I do have some notes on the writing.
Everyone, it's just cuts to the quick. Cuts to the quick.
I don't know if she ever meant for you to see that either. So that was maybe me passing something on that wasn't supposed to be passed on. So I'm sorry, Mom, if I wasn't supposed to tell Gregory that you had notes on his writing, but it made me smile.
You put that as a pull quote on the back of the book, or what did you do?
I feel like we put it as a pull quote somewhere.
Something like on a poster or somewhere we used it. Yeah. But you know, art's easy. The writing part's hard. So you have to do it a lot to get it right.
We'll be fighting at close quarters with the most tenacious of all sea beasts.
I got a little fired up listening to the podcast that you did with George was great. And you guys had a good conversation about the writer's responsibility on a comic and the artist's responsibility on a comic and how that, like sometimes the credit and the profit of a project is divvied up and stuff like that. And interesting conversation. It was a good podcast, you guys, but I'm definitely, I don't agree with him on how that usually works, but.
Interesting. Well, why don't we talk about that? Just for the sake of the dear listener, you can see our listen to our last episode where we talked to George McHale about his new comic Resilient, which I think funded on Kickstarter in under an hour.
Yeah.
I watched the numbers roll over on that.
Oh, that's great. Good for him.
Yeah, he did a great job. And he has got a very good attitude, a business-like attitude to whose responsibility is what when you're making a book. But Justin, I hear you have a different point of view. Why don't you tell us? So that if George is listening now, he knows where you stand.
Yeah, well, it's not, I don't know if I necessarily have a different point of view. That's such a hard conversation to have with a writer who will come along with a story. Cause like I've written some things as well. And I know how long writing takes, and I know how long artwork can take. And it's drastically different. So like a script that was done like, you know, over the weekend and then kind of touched up can translate into 40 to 100 hours of drawing. And then, I don't know, it seems like the artist has to put in so much more time than the writer by the end of that project. And then to still claim that it almost becomes more of the artist. I don't care.
No, just say it. Just say what you feel.
Say, yeah.
We can edit it out if we're going to get you into trouble. Just say it. Let it rip.
When the artist has to spend sometimes 10 times more drawing it than you did writing it, can you really still claim it's yours at the end of the day as the writer? Doesn't that, it kind of become the artist's thing more than yours?
Yeah, it's a chicken and the egg argument. I tend to side, for the dear listener's sake, I tend to side with Justin on this argument that no matter how long you took trying to write something, it probably took the artist longer to draw it. Now, this is not to say that all ideas are created equal and that some ideas don't take a long time to gestate and become excellent. But if you have no medium of expression except that artist, then without them, it's nothing, right? So I tend to agree with that.
And we have all this precedent of, I think, artists kind of being a little underpaid and undervalued when it comes to that relationship. And it's just kind of set in stone that the writer gets more credit, the writer gets more, kind of comes out on top. And it's only now that it's starting to shift a little bit. And that's always just kind of felt wrong to me that the right, especially like if you look in how bookstores do things with graphic novels and comics, a lot of times the artists aren't even like considered. It's all about the writer in the publishing world.
I think about when I was a kid, it was like all about the artists, like Todd McFarlane and Jim Lee and all these big, you know, popular comic book artists, right? I think they also wrote the books though, didn't they? Didn't they write their books as well? I don't remember.
Those, when they broke out an image, they did. Yeah.
They did?
And here's the difference. Okay. And here's where a lot of the, I think the argument would break down is that if the artist was paid a page rate plus a royalty and the writer was paid just a royalty much about who was important. But because so much of the royalty system favors the author, they push for it. I mean, there's some pretty unscrupulous cats out there and they want to make sure their name is first so that they get the biggest royalty share. And, you know, that's just, it's unfortunate that greed gets in the way. When we were first doing Cassian Tonk, Justin thought it was weird of me, but I said, you know, we have to put your name first on the book. And he was looking at, you know, we were looking at comparable titles and he's like, well, the author's name goes first. And I said, yes, but then the bookstore will always leave your name off of it when they solicit it.
Right.
And that's not right. Right. So we put Justin's name, then mine, then his again. Right. So that they would be confused enough that they would usually include, but put the first name there. But we put created by and then written by and then illustrated by, right on the covers, which then kind of busts that system. It's our monkey wrench into the system, right?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, like Dan, like you're saying, I think it's gotten a lot better with comics. Like the writer or the artist is kind of a draw in a lot of cases. The portion of our industry that I was kind of thinking of where I think it is really unbalanced is kids books. Yeah, that's how much right. work
Absolutely
it takes.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. How the artist is almost always kind of a little cliff note in kids' books, and it's all about the author. And it seems like an unbalanced system there.
Occasionally you would have like a partnership between an author and an artist.
Yeah, it's
like,
totally unbalanced.
Robert Munch and Michael Barchenko or whatever.
Yeah.
Those guys would all work together, Robert right? Munch. So almost all. There's a few Robert Munch books that weren't done by him, but for the most part, the name is there. But yeah, you're right. It is more about the author than, even in that case, it's more about Robert Munch than it is about the illustrations.
And I think too, because kids books are often a lot of, it's a lot of times it's newer artists to the industry. It's always one of those first big publishing jobs that artists get is somebody's kids book, you know? So I think that helps plays on it as well.
Yeah, and then they take whatever work they're given. Yeah, they take mm-hmm. whatever work they're given and they're happy to have it. And then the book ends up selling a million copies and they were paid. So what's the problem? Right.
Yeah.
I hate those. Yeah. It's almost like there should be clauses in those contracts that stipulate the number of copies sold.
Like after they sell 500, 1,000 copies, the contract, like something changes.
Yeah, well, I mean, not maybe not that, because those are pretty small numbers in publishing. But if your book sold 5,000 copies, there should be a bump to the illustrator. If it sells 10,000 copies, another bump to the illustrator.
But Greg, you're getting so much exposure. Think of all the exposure you're getting because it sold so many copies.
I love eating exposure salad. Exposure salad is my favorite way to feed my kids. I just give them a big exposure salad.
The last time I got offered exposure as payment, I got to very glibly point out that I had more of a following and more attention than they did. So it should have been the other way around. That was great. Great to be able to do
How
that.
How did that conversation go? I'd be curious.
It wasn't a professional or proper offer. It was like very much just a kind of a phishing Instagram direct message thing. Like, hey, you're an artist. We need artwork. You know, we're starting out. Do this for us. You know, we'll all get paid in the back end and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we're gonna get a great, we're going to reach all these people and blah, blah, blah. And, but they didn't have any kind of plan or couldn't explain as to how they were going to suddenly reach all these people and get all this exposure. And so I kind of, pointed out, you can't prove that to me.
Anyone listening to us who is in that position where someone has direct messaged them on a social media platform, promising them money after they do the work, don't do it.
Just don't.
There's not a scenario where that works out. And you're saying, I know, I can hear you, but if you don't want to be deceived, I will tell you, know what you are hungry for.
But big companies do it all the time.
That's how they stay big.
Food is delicious, isn't it, Professor?
Oh, very good. Never tasted better.
I'm sure you've got a lot of things on the go right now, but what would be your most ideal project to get right now, right this moment, your dream project?
My dream project. There's that old joke about, like, I don't dream of labor, right? I don't have a dream job because I would never dream of labor. But
that's not the case project. With you. Whoa. You'd be so miserable if you couldn't work. Come on.
I know. It's true. Right? My dream project right now, if I had my druthers, would be to be able to design... do character designs, creature designs, and technology designs for a big budget project and see them either turned into an animation or a, you know, even something Invincible level, like, you know, just like a real well done animation, so that where I am in the pipeline is very forgiving, where like you just get to do lots of wild, crazy designs. And then it gets translated into another medium. Like, I get to do that with books all the time. And with role-playing game stuff, I get to make, you know, wild mechs and crazy monsters and then find a way to fit them into a role-playing game. That's easy. But when work gets translated by other people into other mediums, there's a special kind of magic. And we were on our way with that a little bit with our Cassian Tonk animation. And that was feeling really good. And then, you know, just the event happened. So we had to kind of put a pause on that. Yeah. So that's something I find really, I'm doing it in a small way on a bunch of different smaller projects, but I'd love to do it in a much larger capacity, like be able to spend, you know, an entire day just creating from nothing, but do world building. Like people who are working in, you know, like we have a few friends like who have done this before for Netflix shows. They get brought into the art department and they just are spending like 2 months designing, you know, that's like draw us 20 castles, draw us 20 dragons, draw us 20 whatever. And, you know, it gets chosen by the art department to be developed into something else, but you are only given a very small number of limitations. And you've used them chosen for your style. So you just kind of do more of what you do. That would be a pretty ideal situation. I've made a pretty ideal situation for myself in the last few months, as far as like what I'm doing to keep the lights on. So I don't have too many complaints as far as that goes. But if like you say, if I could just wave a wand and get what I wanted, that would be it. It would be like somebody with a law for the next 3 months, and here's a charge card.
Right. Good answer. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Right. But I mean, it comes down to anything. You just want to be recognized for the work that you do, right? It comes down to my sketchbooks again. We're just circling the drain of my ego in this podcast. I just want someone to love me for me, Dan and Justin. That's it.
Ooh.
That's all I want.
I thought of something that kind of combines that, but I think you're going to like it. My ideal project, dream project, would be something like kind of the He-Man toy series kind of thing. So we have bunch of money to develop 6 good guys, 6 bad guys, and a bunch of things in between that get made into toys, short little stories, short little comics, and then we'll get it made into an animation or a movie as well. You know, that whole.
So then we just need a time machine that takes us to 1981.
Yeah. See, wouldn't that be cool?
We need 1981 success. That's what we
need. That's a topic for another podcast. So that's.
Can you imagine traveling back? Yeah, let's do it. You know how we do our story break episodes? Let's do a toy line episode.
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah, I'd be down for that.
This has been Super Pulp Science. We have talked about how genre got made, and we're reminding you that we have a new release of our book, Rust and Water, which has gone through it on the shelves. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.